Okay, now we should welcome Sayaka.
Sayaka, that's right.
As you can see, I had trouble pronouncing her first name because I know her by her nickname of Saku.
Which I prefer, so.
Okay, so I will continue to call you Saku. Saku was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh. She has a BS in physics from MIT, an MS in physics from Brandeis, and an MS and PhD in astronomy from Columbia University. She first got interested in astronomy in her freshman year at college when she took freshman seminars on astrophysics, biophysics, and nuclear physics. The astrophysics was taught by Philip Morrison, who used to write book reviews for Scientific American. And I don't know whether Saku has been able to find the slide that he used or not.
Well, I found something similar that I can use.
Okay, so maybe we'll get to see that ourselves. Saku is currently a research associate at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian, where she has worked as an astrophysicist for over 30 years. She's been a visiting professor at the University of Maryland and Harvard University, and an NAS/NRC fellow at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. She is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She's been awarded a Marie Curie Fellowship by the American Association of University Women and a Science Fellowship by the Radcliffe Bunting Institute. Her areas of interest include the physics of accretion disks and jets, multi-wavelength studies of X-ray binaries and planetary nebulae, science education, and public outreach. So welcome, Saku. A lot of people have been waiting impatiently to hear your talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Yeah, thank you for inviting me to talk at your forum. I look forward to your comments and questions. So I guess I should probably share my screen, Susan.
Yes,
Because
go ahead.
let me see if I can do that. Share screen. Let's find a screen to share. Okay, so I am sharing my screen. Can people see it?
Yes, we can, but we can't read all the small writing.
Right, no, you shouldn't have to. Let me just put this on. There, is that better?
Oh, yes, that's way better.
Okay, good. All right, so let me see if I can get rid of the chat so I don't hide my screen. Okay, good. And I'm going to also, let's try something else. Well, I can't seem to reach it, but okay. So the book, unfortunately, as Susan mentioned, is very highly priced because basically it was published as a textbook for a one semester course on the universe. And textbooks, for reasons I do not understand, are extremely expensive. So I'm sorry, but I can send people PDFs if they want to see that. Wait a minute. So the idea is that for most of our lives, we have looked at the sky in the optical wavelengths. That's part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And I don't know if you can see my arrow, but this is our optical sky as people who are in Chile would have seen it. But it turns out that although the optical spectrum is what we first notice because that's what our optic nerves see, there are many other ways to get energy from space that we can study. And so this book mentions all these other ways. There's four ways which are each related to the four forces that we know of. So the electromagnetic spectrum is related to the electromagnetic force, which is a fairly strong force. Neutrinos are associated with a weak force, cosmic rays with a strong force, and of course, gravitational waves with gravity, which is the weakest of all the forces. Okay, so what's strange is that I'm, oh, here, right. So this is the slide that I was talking about that got me interested in astronomy. So Philip Morrison had shown a slide that was actually handmade by himself. But here, if you look at my arrow, this is the slide, which was made much later, obviously, because I was a freshman in 1970. And what it shows is the behavior of a supernova that went off in 1572. And basically, a supernova is when a massive star explodes, leaving behind a neutron star or a black hole. And this is what's called a light curve. Can people see my arrow when I'm pointing to parts of my screen?
When you move
Yes.
something. Yeah, okay, good. So
Yeah.
this is what's called a light curve. And the light curve is the amount of light received over time as a star starts to expand, explode, and then get dimmer with time, the supernova explosion. And in this particular graph, the star symbols are what Tycho Brahe, when he saw the supernova, explained as the brightness of the object he saw in terms of the size of the phases of the moon and the phases of Venus. And later on, as Morrison had done back in 1970, people took the description of the phase of the moon, converted it into magnitudes, which is how we measure the flux from a star, and plotted them on this plot. And then they plotted two contemporary supernova on the same plot. And what boggled my mind was that this description that Tycho Brahe had made, giving the phases of the moon as the brightness of the star, fitted so well with contemporary supernova that people were measuring. And at that time, my freshman year, 1970, I didn't even know that people could still be studying astronomy. I had sort of relegated all of that as done and over with by Galileo. So I added this quotation because later on I will tell you about a supernova in our own galaxy that happened in 1987. And there were two graduate students who, just like Tycho, had known the stars of the heavens well enough to notice that there was a new star in the sky, and that's how they first detected it. I will show you that image later. So Susan emphasized to me that the forum is definitely not mathematical, and I promise no equations, but I also want to mention that by the 1600s, astronomer Galileo had noted that the grand book, the universe, its story is written in the language of mathematics. And although you may not like mathematics, you really do use it every day. So if you need to paint a room, you want to buy an area rug, you have to calculate your taxes, all of that includes math. And amazingly enough, all of you use physics every day. Maybe you don't play baseball, but most certainly you drive a car. And the physics you use is how hard do you push on the accelerator to speed up? How much torque do you apply to your wheels to make a safe turn? How much friction do you generate with your brake to slow down? How much damage can you do if you crash at 70 miles an hour? You know all this and use it all the time. And by the way, the global positioning system, the GPS that no doubt many of you use, only works because of the application of both special and general relativity. And if I have time, we'll get to that. Okay. So the universe is big and the universe is old. So, and I have to mention that since the speed of light is constant in a vacuum, in astronomy, time also represents distance, the distance traveled at the speed of light. So as one of you mentioned, the distance to our sun is a mere 8 light seconds. That's all the time it takes. But the distance to the next star that is near to us, the nearest star to us other than the sun, is 4 light years. So essentially, anything you study in astronomy is already history. A light year is about 10 to the 15th meters. 10 to the 26 meters is the distance light travels over the age of the universe. And so the universe goes in size from the most microscopic things we know, like quarks, up to 10 to the 26 meters. And the time that we can study is down to as little as 10 to the minus 11 seconds and up to 10 to the 18 seconds. So all the way from the Big Bang, which was 13.7 billion years ago, to now, and I will try and give you an example of each of these, how shall I put them, eras of the universe. So people have studied objects in the sky well before the keeping of written records. This shows some of the earliest dated examples of observatories in Europe and in Africa. No doubt people first noticed the alignment of the sun with natural landmarks and then made artificial and annual clocks where no natural features were available. But as early as 49,000 BC and 4004 BC, people were already using the sun to notice the time of year. So we continue to build observatories that glorify the sun. Here is a picture of Manhattan, which was first built starting in 1811, and it had been aligned exactly east-west. And so there are 4 days in the year that you can go to a given street that is east-west in Manhattan, and you will see the sun come straight down that street. It's perfectly aligned with the sun. By 2000 BC, Babylonians and Egyptians had already had the ability to predict the flooding of the Nile. So here's the Nile pre-flooding and post-flooding. And they were able to predict that time to within 1 day, which is really quite impressive. And because of this, and in general, because the regularity of how the stars moved in the sky could be used to steer ships at sea, caravans on land, it is this ability to predict certain behaviors that led the misconception that stars controlled everything that happened on Earth and started the belief in astrology. And it also gave early astronomers a lot of power and prestige, something I suspect we no longer have. The pyramids are actually amazingly accurately aligned with true north, more accurate than the original Greenwich Meridian, which was established over 4,000 years later. The Greenwich Meridian is still used as a standard today. Of course, it has been rectified as to accuracy, but it was rather impressive that even back 4,000 years ago, the alignment of the pyramids were so accurate. So one of the things that really kept astronomy back for about 2,000 years was Aristotle, the Western philosopher, who was so convinced that the heavens were perfect that he stated as fact, and I've given two quotations, celestial objects are perfect spheres. All celestial objects revolve around Earth. And because he was so highly thought of, this misconception lasted for almost 2,000 years. But 400 years ago, Galileo Galilei did something that no one on earth had ever done before. He took a spyglass, developed, not surprisingly, for the military to look at the enemy armies. He took a spyglass and looked at the sky. On August 16th, 1609, and this is a very idealized photograph or painting rather, Galileo demonstrated his findings to the merchants of Venice. That was 414 years ago when astronomy ceased to be just the study of star movements and our understanding of the universe changed forever. And why is that? It's because Galileo showed that Jupiter had objects that rotated around it. These are the moons of Jupiter, which you should be able to see with your grandson's telescope, and which are really remarkable to watch. They're so beautifully aligned. He also noticed that the moon was cratered and the sun had spots. So objects going around Jupiter definitely showed that everything did not rotate around Earth. The craters on the moon and the spots on the sun showed the celestial objects were not perfect. He was also, for the first time, able to notice that the Milky Way, called such because it was just some white fuzz that looked sort of like milk in the sky, was actually made of many, many, many stars that gave that light. And he was also able to observe the phases of Venus. And things only show phases if they're between you and the sun. So it suggested that things were not all, again, rotating around the Earth. So all of this information so far has been optical light, which is part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and this is the optical view of our galaxy. We call it optic light because our optic nerves can detect it. But energy, it turns out, can come out in any of the electromagnetic spectrum, and these views go from radio to gamma rays. And by the way each of these messengers are associated with one of the four forces, which I've already mentioned, the electromagnetic force is electromagnetism. And it is transferred through space without any physical transfer of matter. It's just photons of light. So, and you can ignore all the equations except to note that they contain the letter C. The letter C stands for constant, which here represents the speed of light. These four equations that James Clerk Maxwell developed totally define the electromagnetic force. The only thing to note, Maxwell's equations were extremely good at predicting anything to do with electricity and magnetism, but they required that the speed of light be a constant. That's all you need to remember. All this phenomena, all these different views of our sky, all produced by atomic processes and beautifully explained when the speed of light is a constant. Okay. So this is an artist's interpretation of the electromagnetic spectrum going from radio to gamma ray. And the main difference between radio, microwave, infrared, visible ultraviolet, gamma ray is the size of the wave of the light that is coming towards you. So radio has huge wavelengths, so what we call long wavelengths, the size of buildings and indeed actually also the size of mountains. And gamma rays are of the size of the atomic nuclei, which is one of the smallest things that we can actually look at. Sorry, these things. Okay. So all of these are just the same thing except the size of their wavelength. And as it turns out, the longer the wavelength, the lower the temperature of the light that you are looking at. And the shorter the wavelength, the higher the temperature and the higher the amount of energy that that light carries. So another factor in how late we started looking at other wavelengths other than optical is because not all wavelengths can penetrate the Earth's atmosphere. So this image shows you the different wavelengths. And optical light actually goes all the way down to the Earth's surface, and many radio wavelengths also go down to the Earth's surface. And those were, not surprisingly, the first light that we received looking at outer space. But all the others, gamma ray, X-ray, ultraviolet, most infrared, and even some microwave, you have to get well above the Earth's atmosphere in order to even detect them. And so, of course, that required us to be able to get above the Earth's atmosphere before we could start using them. So two factors. We had to know that the other wavelengths exist, and we had to know how to get detectors to see them. So it turns out that the first person who discovered infrared light, and that was the first light other than optical that we knew about, was by Herschel, William Herschel, in 1800. And what he did was he basically took light of sunlight, pure sunlight, put it through a prism, which actually brings out the rainbow of colors. And then he used three thermometers to measure. He had one thermometer that was right where the light was displayed, and then two set in off of the light. And he found that wherever the thermometer was within a light source, he actually got a raise in temperature than from the two that were outside of the light source. And he also noticed that as he went from red to purple, the temperature measured by his thermometers went down. And so he was curious, and finally he put a thermometer right outside of all the light that he could see. And he found a temperature higher than that was within the spectrum. And that was infrared, which we can see as heat. And you can see how very different the sky is. Here is Orion, a very visible night sky object in optical, and you just see the stars and nothing else. If you look at it in infrared, you see all this gas in the system of in the sky that you could not see in the optical, glowing brilliantly in infrared. And here is an example of looking at a galaxy in the visible and in the infrared. In the visible, and this is an image made by the Hubble Space Telescope, you see the starlight, which is just the bright white light. But you also see these dark streaks, just as in our own galaxy, and that is actually the dust in that galaxy. And optical, the eye cannot see through dust, so you see it as this dark streak. But if you look in the infrared, you see that dust glowing because, of course, it's hotter, and that you can see only in the infrared. And so you get a totally different image of a galaxy or whatever you look at when you look at in the infrared. And it just provides you with more information about the objects. Of course, another increase in our understanding came from looking through bigger and better telescopes. So here is a sketch of the Whirlpool Galaxy as made by Lord Rosse in 1845. And then you can see the same galaxy as observed with Hubble or with the Spitzer, which is an infrared space telescope, and see how much incredible detail you can see of these galaxies when you look at it with a better telescope. So the radio astronomy started much later, but it had to happen after the radio itself had been discovered. And in 1931, Karl Jansky built an antenna in his backyard because Bell Telephone was having a lot of trouble with sources of static in their signals. And he wanted to see if he could locate what that static was from. And basically, he measured three things. He could measure nearby thunderstorms. He could measure distant thunderstorms. And then he measured a signal, a faint, steady hiss that came apparently from space. And it seemed to rise and fall once a day, and it led him to think that he was maybe seeing radiation from the sun. But he kept looking at it over months. And after a few months, the sun was no longer in the same position in the sky, and the signal continued to come strong and clear from where the sun used to be. So he realized that it had nothing to do with the sun. And as he studied it, he noticed that in fact, it repeated not every 24 hours, but every 23 hours and 56 minutes, which happens to be what we call sidereal time. And that is the time stars take to come back to the same position in the night sky. So it was clearly something that came from space. And it turned out that what he had observed was a radio signal from the center of our galaxy towards the constellation Sagittarius. And he made the New York Times front page news on May 5th, 1933. Now, this is a picture much later from the one he had, but you can see the very strong source of radio that Carl saw. And nowadays, with our very fine telescope, we see these incredible structure far away from the center, all of it emitting in radios, and much of it still to be understood. So radio astronomy is great because you can observe 24 hours a day as opposed to optical, where you can only observe at night. And weather doesn't matter. And what it gave us were our very first detections of pulsars, quasars, and the structure of our galaxy. And again, this is our galaxy. If you looked at it in optical light, you would just see this region. It glow with stars and a little bit of dark clouds, but in radio, you can see these huge plumes of emission going well above the plane of the galaxy. And this shows another galaxy where you can see that the radio emission is totally different from the optical emission, which shows you the starlight from the galaxy. So radios also gave us our first look at the temperature of the Big Bang, and that was called the cosmic microwave background. This had been predicted in 1948 by Gamow and Alpher and Hermann, and independently predicted by Dicky at a much lower level. And there turned out to be exactly the level that was detected by these two, Penzias and Wilson. And again, just as Karl Jansky had noticed an interference in his attempt to find radio signals, the discrepancy that Penzias and Wilson found was very nagging, but they wanted to make sure they could understand it, and they kept on and on trying to find any possible reason. One of the stories, and I don't know how true it is that this antenna, you see how huge the antenna is compared to them. They had a lot of pigeons who sat on that antenna. And so one of the things Penzias and Wilson did was clean all the pigeon poop to make sure that that was not the source of their signal. And no matter what they did, and as carefully as they mention it, this discrepancy in their observations persisted. And it turns out to be the signal from the Big Bang. And I have trouble with this because there's something that's hiding my... Does... please, what's happening? Okay. Well, anyway, what is shown here is the cosmic microwave background, which is a black body. But what you should notice here is these are the lines of the atmosphere from that figure I showed you about how far you had to be above in order to see some light. And it happens that Penzias and Wilson's signal was in exactly that space where light could go all the way down to the Earth's surface. And so they just happened to catch this one point on that curve. But that point had a temperature that completely agreed with the theoretical predictions for what you expected to see from the Big Bang at 13.7 billion years later. But later on, with satellites that went above the atmosphere here, all of these points were found to show that, in fact, it was a beautiful black body, a perfect fit through the theoretical predictions. And I was actually at the AAAS meeting where John Mather first showed this graph with the full curve of the background radiation. And the 2,000 members of the audience instantaneously got up to their feet and clapped because it was such a wonderful realization of theory, and it met observation perfectly. Okay, so when I mentioned that you need to go well above the Earth's atmosphere to look at X-rays, you may have said, wait a minute, X-rays go right through my body. Why can't it go through the Earth's atmosphere? And first of all, we needed to know that X-rays existed, which was discovered in 1895. But we also need to remember that light travels in a wave-like fashion. So remember I showed you the plot where radio waves were bigger than optical waves, were much bigger than X-rays. So you can think of it this way, that all the tiny little particles in our atmosphere of oxygen and nitrogen, these are all smaller than optical wavelengths. So the optical light goes right through. But those same particles are much bigger than X-rays. So when an X-ray light wave hits the particle, it gets absorbed. So think about going through a field of boulders. But since you are light, you can only travel in a straight line, though later on we'll find that light can also bend. And remember, you're traveling at the speed of light. If you're optical light, you're much bigger than the boulders and you can walk right over them. But if you are X-rays, you are much smaller than the boulders. And the minute one is in your path, you are destroyed. So your hand is 3 centimeters thick. And you'll notice that bones do not get penetrated by the X-rays. The atmosphere is 50 million centimeters thick. And what matters for X-rays is the amount of material that they interact with. And basically, by the time they get, they cannot get through 50,000 centimeters of atmosphere, which optical light has no trouble doing. So the basic difference is that for X-rays, it's the total amount of material that you go through, because you will always hit something in your path. And so the 50 million centimeters of atmosphere acts just like a lead brick for X-rays. So the penetrating property of X-rays is why we need a totally different kind of telescope to collect X-ray light. Obviously, if you took X-rays and put them at a mirror, which is your optical telescope, it would go right through. And here's a little demo showing what happens if you're trying to collect X-rays with a regular mirror. And what astronomers found is that they could use an angled mirror because the X-rays would actually glance off at it. If you get it the angle just right, they would glance off and focus if you had a mirror of that surface. And you notice that the surface that you use is very thin. So unlike an optical mirror where you use the whole surface, in X-rays, you're just using a very, very thin angle within that surface. And so what they can do with X-ray telescopes is make many, many layers of metal that will capture different X-rays. And if you look at the optical sky, and again, this is a fantastic, beautiful painting, I will have to say, of our Milky Way, showing the dust lanes along the center. And these are the large and small Magellanic clouds that you can see if you are in Chile. In X-rays, you also see lots of hot gas all over that you would not see in the optical. And you can think of this working this way as skipping a rock. So if you drop a rock, or a stone rather, into the pond, it'll sink right down. But if you happen to throw it at exactly the correct angle, you will get a lot of different rings. And that's the skimming X-rays on the surface. And that's why you need the kind of mirrors that are used to gather up X-ray light. So in 1962, Riccardo Jacconi managed to convince NASA to fund a sounding rocket looking for X-rays from the sun. looking for X-rays from the moon. We had already known at that time that there were X-rays from the sun, but Jacconi wanted to see if those X-rays were bright enough to be reflected off the moon and seen. And a sounding rocket lasts above the Earth's atmosphere exactly 5 minutes. But 5 minutes is a fairly long time. And so as long as you are sending a rocket up there, Jacconi did a quick 360 degree circumference of the sky. And what he found was a source of X-rays that was a million times brighter than what we got from the sun. Now, we all know that the sun is just 8 light seconds away from us. The nearest star to us is 4 light years away. So if the sun has a little bit of X-rays that it shows, what in the universe could possibly have X-rays that are a million times brighter? And what he had discovered was the very first X-ray binary, Scorpius X1. And I think later on, I can tell you why it can be so highly energetic. Here's Scorpius X1. And this is from a much later satellite. I think it's the Einstein satellite. You see how bright Scorpius X1 is as an X-ray source in the sky. If you look at it in the optical, it's somewhere in here. You cannot see it at all with the naked eye, certainly, because it's 400 times fainter than the faintest object you can see with your eye. So one very exciting results from multi-channel observations using X-rays is illustrated in this image of the galaxy cluster IE0657-56, better known as the Bullet Cluster. So the image in the background just shows regular stars as invisible light with the Hubble Space Telescope. The pink overlay and the light, the pink, by the way, is just used to show you the region where we can see X-rays. Obviously, the eye cannot see X-rays. It was observed by the Chandra X-ray Telescope, which is still running at and is run by the Center for Astrophysics. And the blue color represents the mass distribution of the clusters calculated from gravitational lens effects, and we may get to that later or not. But the thing to notice is that the stars of the galaxy were not greatly affected by this collision. This is actually a collision between two galaxies passing through each other, So the stars are not much affected, but the gas the gases actually are interacting and causing both clusters to slow more than the stars. So you can see the gas has gone. This is the stars of the galaxy, and the gas has gone much further. The third component, and the dark matter, which you can tell the existence of by seeing distorted galaxies in the picture, does not follow the gas, which is, you know, material that we know and understand. And this provides support for the idea that most of the gravitation in the cluster is in the form of two regions of dark matter. And these are the dark matter regions, which bypass the gas regions during the collision. And this is in agreement with all predictions of dark matter as mainly a gravitationally interacting source of matter. So indeed, every wavelength gives us different physical information and requires different technology to observe. However, just one look with each wavelength is not sufficient. It is also important that you look with time, because all of these objects are variable with time, from timescales of microseconds to basically the age of the universe. And of course, the farther an object is, the harder it is to see, and not all satellites see all of the sky. So there is a lot of information that is missing. It is like guessing what a jigsaw picture is when you only have a fraction of the pieces. Not surprisingly, as each new wavelength opened up, we found new objects in the sky. Unlike the electromagnetic force, which travels in photons, which are totally massless, cosmic rays are actual particles that come to us from space. And they are related to the strong force that binds the nucleus together. The gravitational force, which is an attractive force, and you know that because any time you throw something up in the air, it's going to fall right back down because of gravity. The gravitational force between two protons is of order 10 to the minus 7 meters per second squared, whereas the electric force, which will be repulsive because two protons will want to repel each other. Opposites attract, likes repel. The electric force is of order 10 to the 29th meters per second. So that's a difference of 10 to the second square, 10 to the 36th. It's a huge amount of force. And that's why it's called the strong force. We know that the protons are all together in the nucleus of an atom, and in order to keep them together, we need a force that is much, much, much stronger than electric force that repulses it, and that is why it was called the strong force. It is the force that glues protons together. So cosmic rays, as I just mentioned, are actual particles rather than photons that come to us from outer space. So the majority of them are just simple protons, basically a bare hydrogen without an electron. 9% are helium, and again, it's the nucleus, not the electrons, which are separated at that at the speeds these are traveling. Electrons, and then a very, very small fraction of heavier particles. And what happens is that as this extremely fast proton hits the atmosphere, it hits a particle in the atmosphere and then produces secondary particles, and it is those particles, pions, muons, and also it generates photons, gamma rays. That's what we actually measure on the surface. So now I don't know why I've mentioned the highest energy reached in human-made accelerators. It's because the highest energy cosmic ray that ever came to us was 10 to the 7 times greater than this, but I think I have a better illustration of that coming down. So gamma rays were first discovered in 1912. I guess I don't have a picture for this, by Victor Hess. And they are the very first non-electromagnetic messenger from space. So because these are charged particles, a proton has a positive charge, an electron has a negative charge, they're actually modulated by the solar wind and by the Earth's magnetic field. So the solar wind makes the incoming particles decelerate and block some of them that have energies less than about 1 giga electron volt. The amount of solar wind is not constant due to changes in solar activity. Thus, the level of the cosmic ray flux varies with solar activity. The Earth's magnetic field also deflects many of the particles and gives basically a daily difference in the amount of cosmic rays that we see. It depends on latitude, longitude, and the angle at which they're hitting the Earth's magnetic fields. And in fact, if you look, the particles tend to be deflected to the poles of the Earth, and that is where you see the northern and southern lights, the aurora. Those are actually cosmic ray particles interacting with the Earth's atmosphere. I'm sorry. Okay, so each second, oh wait. And I also want to show here that because these particles are charged, they do not come to us directly from wherever they were emitted. They are deflected many times by interactions with other particles. And so cosmic rays do not carry any information about the direction from which they arrived on Earth. And that makes it even harder to figure out where they originated. But one thing we can know very well is that we can measure the energy of the particles that we receive on the Earth's surface. And the higher the energy of the particle, the fewer the number of events. So if you had a 1 square meter detector, then you would get 200 MeV events per second. You would get 1 10 to the 18th EV every 50 years. And to date, there has been one event at 3 times 10 to the 20th that we have ever observed. So you can see that the higher energy particles are much less frequent than low energy particles, but even the low energy particles are going to be hard to detect unless you have a very large detector. So one of the things is that although these are actual particles, they are actually traveling faster than the speed of light when they are at the Earth's atmosphere. And it turns out that when a particle is traveling faster than the speed of light in that medium, and I have pointed out to you that there's a maximum speed of light, which is what light travels in a vacuum, but in the atmosphere, speed of light is slower, and in water, the speed of light is even slower. So basically, if you have a particle that's traveling faster than the speed of light, it actually emits photons of radiation, and this is called Cherenkov radiation, and that is actually what we measure. So for cosmic rays going through the atmosphere, the Cherenkov radiation is in fact in gamma rays. So what you use are gamma ray telescopes to collect them. But you can also use water detectors, which will show even a greater Cherenkov effect. And in fact, those are the two major means of measuring cosmic rays. So one of them is, of course, the water tank detectors, which is here. There's also one thing that happens is when you're interacting with nitrogen in the atmosphere, you also cause a light emission, which is called fluorescence. And so you can use certain telescopes to use that. So the Pierre Auger Observatory, and this shows you the size of the observatory on a picture of the Earth. It's huge. It's a surface observatory that has many, many water Cherenkov detectors and about 24 fluorescence telescopes to see the nitrogen fluorescence. And one of the things that having many different telescopes can do is that you can measure the time difference between the ray as it hits one versus the other in order to get some idea of the direction from which the cosmic ray has come. It's not very good, but it does give some directional information. So the highest energy, as I've mentioned before, was one single particle that had an energy of 3 × 10⁰ electron volts. And that basically means it was observed by these detectors, the Fly's Eye Telescope. Basically, it's as though a baseball was flung at a speed of 96 kilometers per hour. And it may not seem like very much to you what a baseball does, but think about the difference in size. The subatomic particle is 10⁻²⁷ kilograms, whereas a baseball is about 0.15 kilogram. So for a particle that size to have the same energy as one this size, that is really, really remarkable. So here is the thing. As I pointed out, because cosmic rays are charged, and so they're deflected by many things in their path to us, we actually do not yet know where they come from. We know their spectrum very well. We know how many come at how much energy, what the flux is, and there's all sorts of interesting deflections in the spectrum that people have all sorts of ideas about. But we have no idea where in the cosmos they are coming from. And yet, it would be really useful because they're so very high in energy, much higher in energy than anything that humans can produce on Earth, so allowing us to detect really high energy phenomena, and it would be nice to know what that phenomena is. Okay, so the next messenger to join the team was neutrinos. Neutrinos were first predicted by Wolfgang Pauli in 1930, and they were postulated because he needed to conserve energy in radioactive decay. So a nucleus by itself tends to sort of decay and release neutrinos sporadically. And because it's done very easily, the force that holds the neutrinos in is actually what's known as the weak force. And the weak force acts only within the size of a nucleus. So it has a very, very small radius of effect. These were named neutrino by Fermi because in must be Italian, the Eno stands for very small. These are particles that have very, very, very little mass, but they are not zero mass as photons. So unlike cosmic rays, which interact with all sorts of particles in our atmosphere, the neutrino is electrically neutral. So it's able to pass through ordinary matter, basically undisturbed. And that means they can be used to study environments that electromagnetic waves cannot penetrate. It also means that they maintain their directional information. They're not at all defected by anything in their path, so you can tell exactly in which direction they come from. However, because they're so very small, because they don't interact in an ordinary way, they're also very, very hard to detect. And again, because of their low mass, they travel very close to the speed of light, and they also can produce Cherenkov radiation because they're going faster than the speed of light in that medium. And in order to distinguish them from the cosmic rays, the detectors to detect neutrinos are placed deep underground, because the cosmic ray would interact with the ground and get absorbed, but the neutrino will not. It turns out the amount of neutrinos you get, say, from the sun on the daylight side of Earth is exactly the same as the amount you get on the night side, because the neutrinos can go right through Earth as though it didn't matter, that it didn't exist. So the very first neutrino was detected in 1965 at the Homestake experiment, which is basically 100,000 gallons of dry cleaning fluid buried 1,500 meters underground. And this is the beta decay, which produces a neutrino or antineutrino and other things. Okay, so the very first detection of two different kinds of messengers was with supernova 1987A, which measured both neutrinos and electric light. And this is what I was mentioning earlier. This is the Large Magellanic Cloud, which you can see from Las Campanas in Chile, the place where I've gone observing, and the sky there is beautiful. And these two graduate students, Ian and Oscar, had stepped out from observing on their telescope to just look at the night sky, and they noticed a star that they had never seen before. They knew their sky as well as Tycho Brahe, and knew that that was a star that had not been there the night before, and they had discovered a supernova, the closest supernova that exploded to us since Kepler's in 1604. And that was supernova 1987A. And here is a picture of that same supernova taken 30 years after the first explosion. And you can see this intricate pattern, which we were able to study in detail. And one of the really interesting things about this supernova is because that area of the sky, the large Magellanic clouds, was so well studied, we could actually identify the star that had exploded in order to create that supernova. And that was an enormous benefit to our understanding of how supernova explode and work. And these are the total detections of neutrinos from that same supernova. And the interesting thing is that the neutrino flash was seen 3 hours before the visible light. And that's because the neutrinos, which came out from the center where things were starting to go awry with the star, it could pass right through all the outer layers of the star, but we couldn't see the actual explosion until the outer layers had blown off. And that is the time difference. And what was exciting is not only that they were detected by one neutrino detector, they were detected by three neutrino detectors. And this is what was detected by the Kamiokande, which is about 1,000 meters underground, measured 11 events, the IMB. And by the way, this is a different illustration of a neutrino event. And there's like 7 neutrinos. All the yellow streaks are the neutrinos coming into the detector. Whereas for supernova 87A, they had seen 8. And then this is one of the layers of the underground scintillator telescope. So 3 neutrino detectors, slightly different telescopes in many different places in the sky, 3 different places, all saw these neutrino events. It was a very, very exciting time. And so, not surprisingly, because it's the closest supernova that appeared when we had all these instruments on hand in modern times, it is probably one of the best studied supernova of all time. And this is an optical image showing how, as the supernova, the material from the center exploded. At one point, it hit a layer of material that had come out earlier from the star and lit it up. And this lighting up of this layer was actually predicted by Dick McRae. And we saw the first light that hit, and we saw it increasing with time until the full ring was lit. And here it is in radio with ATCA and at ALMA. These are all radio observations of the system. And this is an optical observation. This is the Hubble observation. And finally, this is the X-rays. And it's incredible because you can see that the X-rays come where the radio is not, which is sort of interesting. This is the very latest image of this famous supernova taken with the James Webb Space Telescope in the infrared. And let's see. Okay, so the infrared shows these extremely faint outer crescents that have not been seen up to now. But you can also see that there is a sort of keyhole shape in the inner parts within the optical ring of the ring of pearls. So a lot still being learned about this system. And finally, I think I mentioned earlier that when a supernova, a massive star, explodes, it leaves behind a neutron star or a black hole. And for many years, people were wondering if what 87A had left behind was in fact a black hole, because they didn't see anything from the center. But recently, radio observations has detected this hot spot in the center, which is likely the location of the neutron star. And this is the youngest known neutron star that we have studied, because we actually witnessed its birth. I should have had some water with me. coffee doesn't quite work. Okay. So another occasion when we receive neutrino information at the same time as an electromagnetic signal was using the world's largest neutrino detector, the IceCube, which is in Antarctica. IceCube is a square kilometer in area, and it's buried 2,450 meters underground. And this is because that is how deep the ice goes in Antarctica. The holes into which the detectors were placed were made by jets of hot water that were pushed through the ice and the detectors put into place. But it's beautiful because can go so very deep so that you aren't worried at all about cosmic rays. And by the way, IceCube does have detectors on top that can detect cosmic rays, which are not going to be detected below. But you're totally isolated from cosmic rays or anything else. You're really just measuring the neutrino. So the occasion when we saw neutrinos, so of course we have now seen them from a supernova, and we have seen them from what's called a blazar. And a blazar is a galaxy which has a very massive central black hole, and we are actually looking right into the center of that galaxy. So we're not looking at it from the edge as we see our own galaxy, but right down in the center of the black hole engine. And so it's incredibly bright, and they tend to have sporadic and very large, intense gamma ray flare. And it was doing one of these gamma ray flaring episodes that a signal was detected with IceCube at the same time as the gamma rays were detected from this blazar. And by the way, what this shows is all the different detectors that are buried in the ice. So let me go back here. So there are detectors in each of these poles, and so you actually see the direction in which the neutrino is coming in, and I forget which, but I think red is the direction in which it's coming, and green is the direction towards which it's going. But anyway, each one of these was triggered. Each one of these detectors was triggered to give this signal. So that's what these funny little symbols mean when you see a neutrino signal. So this, in fact, is the only source of very high energy neutrinos. These are extremely high energy neutrinos that we have observed, and suggests that because of the number of blazars, because of the strength of what we saw in this one object, maybe about 30% of the neutrinos that are detected by IceCube, the high energy neutrinos, are maybe due from coming from blazars. We still don't know where 70% of the high energy neutrinos are coming from. Okay, so our sun is powered by hydrogen fusion into helium in its core. Okay. And every time it does that, it produces a neutrino. So the sun is the first place that we expected to see neutrinos from. And this was predicted in the early 1960s by John Bacall, who, and actually this is getting a bit louder than I expected, so let's stop. Okay. Oh, no, it's just getting worse. There you go. Okay, sorry. I didn't expect it to be quite so loud. So it turns out that the Homestake experiment, which I had shown you earlier, detected neutrinos from the sun, but they only detected about one-third of the amount of neutrinos predicted by John Bacall, which was a little bit discouraging. By the way, this is a double rainbow over Australia, and that is, in fact, sunlight. So it's another picture of the sun. So for a long time, people were very, very disturbed by this discrepancy between the theoretical prediction and the actual observed number. And it was called for over 30 years, the solar neutrino problem. And it was finally solved by the Super Kamiokande. Now, I had shown you Kamiokande 2, which, and I forget the amount of gallons it had, but Super Kamiokande had, that should be another zero in there, basically 13 million gallons of ultra-pure water. And it turns out that neutrinos come in three flavors. There's the electron, the muon, and the tau neutrino. And it turns out that dry cleaning fluid is only sensitive to one of them. And that's why Homestake only measured one-third the number of neutrinos expected. And Super Kamiokande could actually see the all three kinds and saw the number exactly as John Bacall had predicted. And it was the first neutrino detector that actually it took a picture of the sun in neutrinos. And as you can see, it's all coming from the very core of the sun, where the fusion from hydrogen to helium is going on. So now we come to the final. How are we doing for time? I don't have time on my
Yeah,
screen.
we're running late,
We're
Sakura.
running late.
Yeah, so
Oh
we need
gosh, I'm
to.
sorry. So I can actually just stop and you can ask me
Oh,
questions.
well, can we just ask you a question? Can you just say a couple of sentences on
Yes,
gravity
I will say a
waves?
couple of sentences about gravity waves. So basically, the reason Einstein developed his theory of gravity is because while, oh wait, I'm no longer going to do this. So Newton's theory of gravity worked very well on the Earth, but it actually was not able to predict the orbits of the planets. I mean, the shift was microscopic, right? Because the observed shift was 5,600 arc seconds per century, and only 5,557 were accounted for by Newton's gravity. He was off by 43 arc seconds. Meanwhile, Maxwell's laws, as we had mentioned earlier, worked perfectly for everything it worked in, but there was a discrepancy between the two. Newton's gravity required light to not be constant and to add up the speeds with time, whereas Maxwell's laws said light was a constant. And so Einstein went with Maxwell. And all sorts of odd things happen when you say that light is a constant. So it turns out energy and mass are equivalent. Clocks slow down when you're moving. Mass increases when you're moving. Objects shrink in the direction of motion. All sorts of things that were basically totally against common sense. But as you can see, Einstein did not believe in common sense. He said, this is something that is put on you before and by the age of 18, you are no longer able to imagine things. So he didn't care. He went with Maxwell. And so he developed his theory of gravitation, which was even more bizarre because light itself, in spite of being massless, was influenced by gravity. Light bend doesn't travel in straight paths as we have thought. So you can ignore the equations. The main thing is that gravity takes time to be felt. It is not instantaneous as Newton believed. So gravity is basically becomes a geometric property of space and time. So this is an embedding diagram that people use, and it's a two-dimensional a description of a four-dimensional space. So basically, if you put a ball on a flexible rubber sheet, it will distort the sheet depending on the mass of the ball. And so what you're seeing here is two-dimensional space and the warping then happens in the third dimension. For us, since we are actually in three-dimensional space, the warping of the space happens in the fourth dimension, which can be considered time. And so it's a concept that's very hard to illustrate or accept. But Wheeler had two very good quips, which tell you that basically mass distorts space. So it tells space how to curve, and space-time tells the mass how to move, because it will certainly fall down into those lines. So although the concepts are really difficult to swallow, the fact is that with time, the predictions they made were well verified. And I won't go into that, but I will just show you, in fact, the final, the very last of the channels opened up in 2015 when we detected the first gravitational waves from space. And this just shows the pattern of what you see. And I'll go back here to show you. Basically, when they're farther away, the waves are very far apart. In the middle, it's really messy, and that can only be done with computer simulations, as was done by Joanne Centrella. But the ring town is the thing that we actually observe. And I will show this one so that you can see the pattern. So you see it going up.
Let's see.
So at the very end is that little thing, and that's what you saw. That's what we detected here in those two detectors. And I'll stop now, because I didn't realize I was going so long. Okay. All right.
All right. So, thank you.
Shall I stop sharing screen?
Okay. Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah.
Oh, that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating, Saku.
That was wonderful.
You really didn't notice all the time going by.
Right, okay.
It was great.
Yes. And we still have 10 minutes for anybody to make any comments or ask any questions. But so Linza, can you unmute, please?
Yes, thank you, Saku. So the picture, the original four pictures you showed us with the gravitational waves that look like the inside of a seashell, what are those a picture of?
Yes, so that the simulation was of two black holes going around each other. And so the spirals that you saw are meant to depict the gravitational waves that are coming out from these. So they're very massive systems that are going around each other, and the closer they get together, the faster they're moving, and the more gravitational waves come out. And, and yes, they look spirally because they're rotating. The two systems are rotating against each other, around each other.
Thank you. Thank you.
So Barbara, what did you want to ask?
Thank you for that wonderful talk and your wonderful visuals. This may be a silly question. I'm not sure. Do multi-universes exist, or is that just a wild idea?
Well, there is no way for us to know, right? I mean, we can only tell what's in our own universe, but there is no way I can tell you that there aren't many, many other universes out there. So, I mean,
Someday,
let your imagination go wild.
Okay. Is it?
Marianne has her hand up.
Oh, Marianne, I can't see you.
I'm so sorry I missed the bulk of this. So I hope it was recorded. But I did see the last slide, and I heard the da-da-da, beep.
Yeah.
And so what were we hearing then? Was that?
Okay, so what we're hearing is, okay, so you cannot really hear gravity waves. So this is sort of like translating gravity waves into sound.
Okay.
And okay. So what you measure at the very last infall, I mean, they're spiraling around, gravity waves are coming, and those are the waves that you saw. And then at the very end, when the two black holes collide with each other and form a single black hole, there's a huge spike of gravitational waves. Okay. And that's that, it would sound like a beep if it was in sound.
Okay. Thank you. Fascinating.
Yes.
Ivel?
Oh, hi. Wonderful lecture. And the, Ron and I watched it as a couple. So that was really great. And, he absorbed a lot more rays than I did. but what I was thinking of is, when I was in South America, in San Augustine, on the mountaintop, they had revealed giant stone effigies, and they were all facing upward with, it looked like earphones. and that was, I saw them back in the 70s, and they said, oh, well, we dig one up every once in a while.
They're listening to the music and the stars.
And I wish they had had your lecture to inform them. But yeah. Who knows what mysteries were unveiled and then lost again. And now, you know, we're just moving forward. So thank you. I have to run and drop off a piece of artwork or else they'll leave. Yeah. So, and Ron is with the dog. He says, okay. Thank you.
Okay. It's
Thank you. All right. Paula.
Yeah. Oh. Hi. I just wanted to say thank you very much for giving this lecture. I mean, if you gave me a quiz, I might fail it, but I'm fascinated by everything you said and I took notes. So I really look forward to looking at my notes and it was very, very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, does anybody else want to say anything?
Barbara does again. Barbara Sweet.
Yes.
Perhaps another silly question. Since we are part of the Milky Way, how are we able to take a picture that shows the entire Milky Way?
Yes, so that picture
of it.
Yeah, the picture does not have the Earth in it, but the picture is taken from observatories all around the Earth. So we see everything that surrounds us. And the image that you see of our Milky Way is so-called ATAF projection. So sort of like the way Earth is put into a map, that's sort of an ATAF projection. And so what you're seeing is that circle that we've looked around the Earth basically spread out in one direction. But it's everything we see from Earth. The Earth itself is not in there.
Fascinating.
Ed, can you unmute?
Yes, I'd like to find out about the future of astronomy. What directions astronomers are paying most attention to at the moment, and where do you think NASA is going to go in the near future?
Well, okay, so let me share my screen again, if I can.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and just go to my, what's happening? It's not, there you go. Here. So this was supposed to be my last slide. So basically in the electromagnetic spectrum, we have seen almost all wavelengths, but we haven't seen as far as we'd like to see, so we want bigger telescopes. We haven't seen the resolution, so we need more spectrographs. And so we continue to look. And the one thing that is really important is to try and look at many different wavelengths at the same time. And that's very hard to do because it's hard to coordinate space vehicles to observe at the same time. Though I have done it on occasion. I did one occasion where I had Hubble, which is ultraviolet, I was using it as, and Chandra is X-ray, look at the same time at the same object so I can see what the spectrum of the light is from there. And I knew someone who was in the mission planning, and they said they had put a little image of me up and used it as a dartboard because it was so hard to do the coordination and I needed it done 6 times. But yeah, so that is something that we really need to do. One of the ways to do it is to put up one telescope that to put up one satellite that has several wavelengths at the same time. That would make it a lot easier to coordinate. And there is one up there right now that was put up by India, but because it has 4 different wavelengths, each of the wavelengths is a much smaller telescope. And so you can't go as deep, but it is very good for timing studies. And then there is the cosmic rays. You want bigger and better arrays because we cannot tell the direction which they're coming. You want to be looking at objects of interest with many different instruments so that in case something exciting goes off in one of them, if you can associate a cosmic ray with that, that would give us some idea that that's where the cosmic ray came from. For neutrinos, you can see the original ice cube is right here, and they are doing ice cube generation 2, which is going to be much, much bigger. And it'll also have radio telescopes above ground so that you can do simultaneous looking with different telescopes. And finally, for gravitational waves, we've in some sense seen the very short frequency wavelengths with the cosmic microwave background, and we have seen the highest frequencies with the LIGO, there's at least 3 different LIGOs spaced apart so that they can tell directions better. But the two in between, there's pulsar timing, is going to take a lot more time to develop all the telescopes for that. And there is a space interferometer that will go up that will allow us to look at many different objects. So yeah, there is every effort on every of the channels, not only to see further but also to try and see it with different channels so that you can identify the cosmic object from which the information from the other channels has come.
Thank you, Saku. And thank you, Ed, for asking that very interesting question.
Okay.
Saku, people ask, I understand that we can't post the slides online, but I wondered if it'd be possible for you to be able to send them to me so that I could email them to people who request them?
Yes. Yes, I can do that.
That would be really great. And I will try to post the audio online, as I said.
Okay, very good.
Okay, and just because I forgot to, do I have your permission to record all this?
Yes, you do. It's okay.
Okay.
Lost all of you. I don't know where you are, but.
Okay. Better late than never.
Okay.
Okay, and thank you so much. This was a wonderful talk.
Thank you.